All right. So, welcome again to the Overeaters Anonymous Northern Virginia Intergroup's presentation on Living with Dying, Recovery and Loss. Our invitation to you, which is read at many of our meetings, reminds us that once we become abstinent, we then find that to deal with our inner turmoil, we have to have a new way of thinking, of acting on life rather than reacting to it. In essence, a new way of living. To recover, to stay abstinent, and to live our best lives, we must learn how to deal with the buildup of human emotion that drives us to food. As addicts, our first reaction to emotional discomfort is to react by turning to our drug of choice. For compulsive eaters, our default is to numb ourselves by binging, vomiting, or excessively exercising or restricting. Focusing on what we think we can control distracts us from what we're afraid we can't. But how do we deal with strong emotion if we don't have food? By working and living the 12 steps passed down to us here in OA by the authors of Alcoholics Anonymous or the Big Book. Because the truth is, the only thing that we can control is our actions. An emotional discomfort we will all experience, and maybe the worst, is the end of life. Loss, grief, and fear may seem overwhelming. Fortunately for us, the Big Book teaches us that the actions we can take as we experience these painful emotions, and living the OA program brings us into a loving and compassionate community that gives us the strength we need. We are not alone anymore. Today, we are blessed to have Amy A. and Melissa C. joining us, who will share their experience, strength, and hope on dealing with death from both sides, both a terminal diagnosis and caring for a loved one as they approach the end of life. Each speaker will have 30 minutes, and I will be manning the timer. And then after that, we will be sharing. So, Amy, I am now turning the meeting over to you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Amy. I'm a compulsive eater and a food addict. And, I have been in program for a long time, since 1988. And I am, this is wonderful to be able to speak to all of you. On a, and I'm sorry about the topic. I'm sorry that I get to be the one who gets to talk about this topic. I'd rather take Melissa's place. I've been in, I don't want to take too much of what Melissa's going to talk about, but I come to the place I'm in from having had many experiences with death and dying in this time period. I'm sorry, just was distracted by something flashing across my screen. But anyway, since I've come into program, I've had my grandmother die. She died when I was about 6 months abstinent. I've lost a couple sisters, a couple of brother-in-laws, my parents, my mother-in-law, and I also spent a lot of time, a wonderful time with a group that sang to hospice. So that's kind of how I come into this. I'm trying to think of like, so, the most important thing is I come to this experience of being given a diagnosis that is, treatable but not curable. I have liver cancer. And so, it's treatable but not curable. And if I did nothing, the doctor said it would be a year. And if I did things, chemo, immunotherapy, et cetera, that maybe I'd get two, maybe I'd get, who knows? The longest he'd ever seen was five. My first scan was what it was, and the second scan was much better. Ooh, what does that mean? And you start getting ideas. I start getting ideas of like, maybe I can be the one who pushes his number out. Wouldn't that be fun? But no guarantees. And I, having had all the loss that I've had in my life, watching other people make decisions about these last periods of time in their life, one of the things that became very, very clear to me is that I did not want to spend my last days, weeks, years chasing a cure outside of my house and my friends and my family. I wanted to be able to spend more time, good time, with friends and family. And that's what good time means to me. And I've come up against other things that good time also means to me, of that, I want to live and be as fully me as possible. So, I want to get on planes sometimes by myself and go places. I want to have people in program call me and tell me about their terrible day, right? Because that's part of who I am. And and that's been one of the harder things in within the program setting, is the number of people who are like, compared to what you're going through, it's like, no, come on, I'm just another people. Come on, let me be another people this minute. People who want to put me on a pedestal, or people who want to tell me what to do, these are all exciting bits of the journey I'm in. But I want to point out that I come to this also not only with that background of having had a lot of loss and having watched people and having made had thoughts about what I would do if, from having watched other people. But also, I've been in program for more than 3 decades, and I've done a lot of work in that. I can't say that I work a hard program or a super disciplined program or this, that, and the other. What I know is I've done the steps over and over and over again. And I've struggled with my lack of belief in a higher power over and over and over again. And as I was writing down notes for today, I realized that what I believe in is reality. And that was a big deal when I was in my disease, of imagining that life was something different than it was. And if I just did X, Y, and Z, that I could lose 10 pounds a week and, look good in a bathing suit by such and such a date. That's not real. Or if it's real, it's real for 37 seconds and doesn't last. And I want real, and I want truth, and I want connection that is lasting. And I've gotten so much of that that, I just believe that it's possible. I believe it's possible for you far easier than I believe it's possible for me. And but having had that change of personality, because in Appendix 2, it says that a personality, change sufficient to support recovery is kind of the definition of a spiritual experience. And I've had that spiritual experience. I believe in that. And I mean, who knows? The reality is, and I hope this doesn't come as a shock to every one of us, is I'm not the only one in this room who is dying. And it's and I'm not even talking about the people I know who have, life-threatening illness. I'm talking about, that newborn baby that you last held. That is an entity with an end date. The only thing that's different right now is that I have somewhat more accurate idea of when my end date is than do the vast majority of people. And it was a kind of a shocker for me because my parents both lived into their 90s. So I woke up in February on my 65th birthday thinking, 30-ish more years, cool. And, only to have that shaken to the core in May, where it's like, whoa, that's a tenth of what I thought it was. Now what do I do? And I will say that my biggest grief, the biggest cries I've had have been over things I thought I just, would be there for, watching grandchildren, watching, children do amazing, my own children do amazing things. I had a sponsee who had to race her husband who'd had a small stroke off to the hospital, and I had a huge breakdown that I wouldn't be able to be there for my husband in 15 years if something like that happened, because I'd be good at it, and it's just like, okay, that's isn't that wild? Like, that's not a good thing, but those were the things I expected. And now the window is shorter. And I have a choice. I can make it, to me, I don't even have a choice. I just have to keep going and, and do my very best to pay attention and make it as sweet as possible. At the same time, knowing that, for those of us who've had children who are now grown, and for those of us who currently have small children in the room, we've all been on one side or the other of this conversation in the grocery store. Oh, those were wonderful days. Enjoy them. And, if you are the young mother with a one-year-old, a three-year-old, and a five-year-old who are trying to chuck stuff out of the grocery cart and pull each sister's hair, and it is not a wonderful day. It is not a wonderful day. And you look up at this, slightly deluded grandma person and think, oh, for the love of God. But on the other hand, those of us who are now in the grandma shoes, even though I do not have a grandchild at this point, we remember those days with great sweetness. And so, I'm in another phase of life where the days aren't necessarily going to be great, but I can still make the weeks and the years full of meaning. And I'm grateful to program for that. And I'm grateful for program for continually putting me back on my side of the street. One of the things that comes with a terminal illness with cancer is, and other situations, are people and they're well-intentioned ideas of what will fix me. And some of them I'm happy to try, and some of them I'm not going to try. And and just to continually be kind and firm about whatever it is, and encourage people's love while discouraging, advice, which I was once in a, different type of meeting, an Al-Anon meeting, where somebody said, all advice offered to, and they were talking about adult children, but I honestly think it applies to everybody on the planet. All advice offered to anyone is viewed as criticism. And that has helped me immensely. It doesn't mean I never offer advice to my children, but it, as I'm offering advice, I hear, they hear this as criticism. And, when people say, oh, if you just ate, 2.7 ounces of X daily, then this would miraculously be healed. There is also an implication that if I had done so 15 years ago, that I wouldn't have this now. And, and that I don't believe I've actually done anything to bring this upon myself. Nor do I believe that I can actually, by right thinking, right, specific eating, et cetera, magically make it go away. I wish it were that simple. And if it, if you're in that situation and it makes you feel better in a day, in a week, in a year, then that is for you. It just isn't my way. And I'm grateful to have this time to kind of think about, like, what is my way? What do I need? What's going to work for me today? And it may not work tomorrow. I mean, yesterday I woke up and I was fatigued from the moment I opened my eyes. And yet I couldn't, like, lots of times I nap now, which I never used to do. Yesterday was, I couldn't nap, and I don't know whether it was distractions or what else was going on, but I was sort of too tired to sleep. And so I just dragged through the day, as pleasantly as I could, and and God bless the people who live with me who let me be cranky with them sometimes. But I try not to overdo it. Then today I woke up and I feel good. And I'm so grateful because I was, yesterday I was a little worried about how I was going to do if I was going to be in a second day of fatigue. And that's, that's the kind of thing where, back into that one day at a time, sometimes 1 minute at a time. And, the other thing, just in terms of, the program and, my food plan and all of that, is that, this is a pretty powerful excuse, isn't it? Completely. Like, oh my gosh, if there's ever a time to just let go of things, wouldn't this be it? And, I don't know, about 20, 25 years ago, when my children were very small, it was in this house, so it couldn't have been 25. But I had five small children, and they are 9 1/4 years apart. So you can do the math. If the youngest one is two, the oldest one is 11 and a quarter. And, so it was chaos around here all the time. And, looked at backwards, lots of joy. In any given moment at that point, not necessarily. But there was one day, and I don't remember what it was, but I had had what seemed to me to be a big enough deviation in my food plan, not a break of abstinence. I claim imperfect abstinence from July 13th, 1988, which I looked at my phone this morning. It is 15,604 days ago, which is, an insane number of days, but you just get up and do it again. But this day, some 27 years ago, I shared with a sponsee that I'd had done XYZ. And she, bless her, said, well, that's so understandable. And like, I don't know what my tone was like. I hope it wasn't harsh. But what came flying out of my mouth was, I do not want my completely understandable relapse. And you know what? I still don't want my completely understandable relapse. And one of the things I've found is I, struggle with, three meals is often not quite enough. But if I eat four meals that are the same size as the three meals were, then I'm too full. And I try and, but what's a meal? And so there's a lot of maneuvering around as I readjust to a body that's dealing with, chemicals being put in it every, 2 weeks out of every three, and blood counts that go down so that I can't have the chemicals put in, and yeah, dot, 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 dot. As I'm dealing with all of that, then the question becomes, what exactly is my food plan? But what's clear is my abstinence is about, having a clear head, having a clear mind, having no sense of shame, having open connection without shame with, whatever it is I call my higher power, that connection to truth, that connection to others. And it's about feeling as good as I can in my physical body, which, at this point, sort of the slightest bit too much food actually makes me feel terrible for several hours because I'm just not, liver is involved in digestion. So I'm thinking that's probably part of it. That's where I go, is that I want to be, have that level of freedom on a daily basis where I feel good and I feel connected. And, when my older sister was dying, and she had a glioblastoma, a very, very deadly type of brain cancer, I would go out there to visit, to help. And I'd been abstinent, oh, 10, 12 years at that point. And I became very clear that my being abstinent was the best way I had of honoring my relationship with her, of honoring my grief. And, that is as true today as it ever was. And, I just want, and I still want, around food and around life, to have connection with that thing that is greater than myself, that, mystical, magical thing that is better than what I come up with by myself. All by myself, this looks to me like a situation that, you could just kind of crawl into a hole or crawl into your sofa, and, have three bags of this, one bag of that, and something else, and stay there all day under the covers and never stop the nibble. And, today that doesn't look to me. That doesn't look like something I want to spend a day doing, let alone the rest of my life. I want to, sometimes get onto that sofa and try and figure out, like, do I need a nap? Should I sit up a little bit and knit? Should I make a phone call? Like, what's gonna make the next 15 minutes better than the way I feel this minute? And I am grateful as anything that, I am feeling pretty good most of the time. And I haven't had a lot of the side effects that I was concerned I was going to have. You know, I chose to cut my hair short and it never has really fallen out. It's thinner than it was. You know, those kind of things. And it doesn't mean that, you know, the other thing I'm coming to grips with is the idea that no matter how long I live, I will be in treatment for the rest of my life for the cancer. And the same thing is, of course, true for all of us with our, you know, addictions is, you know, in order to have a good day, a good week, a good year, you know, here we are. One of the things I would love to have happen, you know, I already know a handful of people who are walking a path very similar to mine right now. But if I don't have your contact number, and I will go ahead and put my phone number in my square, as well as in the chat box. But I know how with a meeting this size, the chat box can get completely lost. So, but you may text me your information because, you know, I don't have the energy to have a weekly meeting right now, but I think I'd love to have a place that I go maybe once a month, you know, a Zoom meeting or something where, you know, those of us who are in this process can, you know, check in with others who are in this process and, you know, be of support to one another. And I am grateful to be here and grateful that you all are here. And this is an amazing, it is amazing that, you know, to have learned long, long ago in these rooms that, you know, everything that happens to us, you know, that the meaning comes from being of service to others. And, you know, those of us, and when you give service, you get back. And, you know, I appreciate all of you being here. And, you know, thank you for to Kate for making this happen and for all of you in making this happen. So, but again, I'll put my name or I'll change my number. I'll add my number to and add my I'll add my number and my email address to my square. And please contact me whenever possible. Bob, I think Melissa's going to talk before we let you talk, darling. And there we go. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Amy. And yes, questions are after Melissa's share. Thank you for your bravery and your honesty. And I will now turn it over to Melissa.
Yeah, thank you. Gosh, Amy, thank you so much. What an honor and a privilege to really hear your story and a little daunting to come after, I have to be honest. But thank you. Thank you. I really, so, you know, my exp I'm Melissa Sam, a recovered compulsive overeater. I live in New York. And, you know, for me, my story is that I've experienced some really painful losses. And it made it difficult for me to find a concept of God. Like that was my struggling, that was my stumbling block. And I want to say that the losses that I've experienced did not cause my compulsive eating. Like I was well practiced in the act of binge eating many, many years before I experienced my own, like, you know, experiences of personal tragedies. And in fact, I often think like, you know, I began compulsive eating as a child, as a very, very little child. And in a way, I kind of cringe to say it, but I'm going to say I'm actually grateful that that's what I had, because I had a substance that was readily available, that was legal, that I could get, because I did not have any other means of dealing I don't know why. I just didn't with the losses that I experienced and the food. It allowed me to survive, I think, until it didn't, you know, until it didn't. And I did not have a connection with God. And so I ran to the food because the food was the thing that just allowed me to like blot out the consciousness of the intolerable situation. Whatever that intolerable situation was for me, it was some losses. And you know, and then I came to Overeaters Anonymous. My, you know, my story for OA and recovery is I came in here, I was, you know, repeatedly I came in, but I really the last time I came in and stayed, I was over 300 pounds and I was really angry and really sad because of what had been happening, I believed to me. And I had this belief that God had screwed me, that he cheated me, and that he abandoned me. That was what my story was in my head. And, you know, one of the losses that I've experienced was I had a lot of late pregnancy losses, but I lost a child. We had we had a child that lived a day and then he died. And he came after many other pregnancy losses in between my two children. And so I had pleaded, like, you know, I remembered pleading for my son to live. And I felt like that desire was pure and loving, and therefore, and it came from my heart, unselfish in nature, and therefore it was worthy of God's intervention. And how dare there be a God that didn't intervene on my behalf? And it made me really, it made it hard for me to find a connection with God. Hard, but not impossible. That's the good news, because for me, the pain of obesity and the fact that I couldn't seem to help myself drove me back into OA. And I, you know, they say like beaten into a state of reasonableness. That's what happened to me. And at the end of, you know, for me, my disease turned out to be a blessing and a miracle, because what it did for me was it presented me with a necessity for God. And through my addiction was really how I found God. I found God in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous. And I actually, through the working of the 12 steps, I found a way to forgive God, right? Because I needed to have forgiveness for my creator and let him back into my heart. And, you know, I was told God comes in through your wounds. And I had some pretty big gaping wounds that God could enter through. So, you know, and I'm a practitioner of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I always kind of hold it up. This is my, this is where I find my strength and my direction. And it says, and there's a solution on page 25, that the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences, which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. And so, on my own, I could not change my attitude toward life. I couldn't change my attitude towards my fellows. I certainly couldn't change my attitude towards God's universe. You know, I had this attitude, I want to say it was arrogance. You know, I had this fundamental and unshakable belief that if I had been given a different life, then I would be happy. If those things did not happen to me, then I would be happy. And I realized, you know, upon working the steps, that I pushed away my God-given emotional need to grieve. Like, grieving is not a defect, I want to say. Feeling sad is not a defect, and it's not meant to be whisked away. You know, it needs to be honored and acknowledged. And but there's a difference between self-pity and sorrow. And I lived in self-pity. And what self-pity does is it pushes other people away. It closes the door on receiving comfort. So, and it lives in solitude. You know, it thrives in solitude. And And it lived in this lie. And here was the lie that I lived with. I had this lie in my head that I'm expected to blank, whatever it was. I felt like I was expected to go to work, throw birthday parties, socialize, smile, fake my way through life, like just fake, fake, fake. And it lived in the lie that others don't care. Right? Because I was presenting like I'm okay. So then nobody can come in and let me know that they care. Right. And so it zoned in on where others were failing me. Like it was like they're failing me here. They're failing me there. And it cursed the universe. I like cursed the universe that took what I believed was mine. And that was my problem, that I saw my son back then as my possession. This child that lived today was mine and it was taken from me. He belonged to me. And so I walked around angry at people. And for me, it was mostly women. Like that was the truth. I really was very angry at other women who were able to have lots of children, that, were able to increase their families seemingly whether they wanted to or not, right? Like everybody was just having all these babies around me, and I would cringe with jealousy when I saw a baby in the arms of someone I loved. And I hated myself for being that kind of person. Like who hates to see their sister with her children, or your neighbor with their children. And here was the thing, right? I couldn't change my attitude. I kept like shaming myself, like, what is wrong with you? Change your attitude. And I couldn't, because I had a deep-rooted selfishness. I did not want others to get what I knew was rightfully mine. I really had never taken the third step. I didn't even come to know that I was powerless. So what kind of third step? And a third step is really where you say, yeah, I don't get to decide what's mine and what's not mine, you know? But I saw from that perspective, I saw that the good things that others got was evidence that there wasn't going to be enough for me. Like that's what my false belief was. And I did not understand God's economy. And in God's economy, good gets multiplied and not divided. And I think about it like it operates in the same way love does. Love is not a pie that you divvy up and now there's less for you because you're giving it to someone else. It doesn't work like that. And but jealousy tells me that there's just so much to go around, right? That there's not going to be enough for me. And what happened for me was my jealousy turned me into someone I didn't like very much. You know, and so it wasn't just like I was experiencing the loss of a child. In that case, it was a child, but I experienced the loss of me because I was becoming someone I didn't even know and like, you know. And so on page 29, it says this: each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in our lives. So that's my charge. That's always my charge, today and always. Like, I'm supposed to, oh, that's my dog. I'm supposed to use my personal story to explain how I established my relationship with God. And I do it because I believe that that's what I'm being called to do. That's, I believe, is my purpose. And but I don't believe that God, my belief in God is not that he had this happen to me with the intention of me doing this work. Like I just think God wants me to take whatever my pain is and transform it into something useful, beautiful, if I can, right? So I'm pretty certain, right? I was born a compulsive eater. My earliest memories, sorry for my dog barking and barking. I don't know if you hear it, but I apologize. Nothing I can do. You know, My earliest memories were all food. I did not become a compulsive overeater because of my loss. I did not discover food when my, child died or when I experienced miscarriages, but I turned to the food because it was my lifelong go-to. It was like just what I used. It was what I always turned to when I couldn't handle what was happening. And I think what it was somehow I got this idea that pain and discomfort must be avoided, skipped over, and ignored. Like just ignore it. And so, and we agnostics in paragraph, it says this, it talks about one night when confined in a hospital, he was approached by an alcoholic who had known a spiritual experience. And as our friend's gorge rose, as he bitterly cried out, "If there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me." But later, alone in his room, he asked himself this question: "Is it possible that all the religious people I've known are wrong?" While pondering the answer, he felt as though he lived in hell. And then, like a thunderbolt, a great thought came. It crowded out all else. Who are you to say there's a God? And this man recounts that he tumbled out of bed to his knees, and in a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. And it poured over and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great tide at flood. The barriers he had built through the years were swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He stepped from bridge to shore, and for the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his creator. So for me, after years of suffering with the disease of compulsive overeating, I reached a point where food stopped working. I couldn't get numb, it didn't work, and it was a blessing, but at first it felt like a curse. And I was at a point, I was like having these panic attacks on my way to work. I would be eating for it was shredded wheat cereal until my mouth bled. Like, and it hurt to chew and it tasted disgusting and I couldn't stop. And really what happened was I cried out to a God that I didn't believe in. And he heard my prayers. I mean, that's the only thing I can say, that I cried out. I was like, I surrender. I don't care anymore. At that point, I was like, I don't care what you tell me to stop eating. I stopped negotiating and I began to follow directions. And at step two, I was hit with my first huge stumbling block because I didn't know that I could come to believe in a power that could restore me to sanity. How do we consider that God would intervene on my behalf with the food when he hadn't intervened on the other problems? Like that was my big problem. And so Bill's story kind of explains it. It's kind of like this, when the thoughts express that there might be a God personal to me, like, I don't like that idea, right? Because it's not making sense with me. And that, I was told, like Bill was told, choose your own conception of God. And that statement for me hit me hard. And he talks about the icy intellectual mountain, right? That he's in this icy intellectual mountain. And that was my problem. I had this icy intellectual mountain. I really understood the concept that my mind was broken. I got it, that I couldn't rely on my thinking. I didn't like it, but I got it. And then I'm being asked, I was like, well, now you want me to use my broken mind to make up a conception of God? Like, I don't get it. That doesn't make any sense to me. You want me to take my broken mind and make up God? And for me, I had this moment. I really feel like it was truly a spiritual experience. I heard the voice of my father who had passed. Like, he was one of the many losses I'd experienced. When I came in again, yes, I was like reeling from the loss of my son, still hanging on to that, even though I had had another child. And everybody told me, by the way, you ought to be happy now. You have another child. Like, get over it, which is horrible. Who would, but that was some of the stuff that I was being doled and then hated myself for still feeling sad, right? But I came in here, on the cusp of my best friend dying, another close friend dying, my dad died, and my father-in-law died. And now here I am, choose your own conception, Melissa, right? And what God did for me was I heard this voice in my brain. It sounded just like my father. And the voice was this: stop being so smart. You want to get better or not? And that, like, it's that is exactly the language my father would have used to me. Like, you don't know everything. My dad used to say this expression to me, Melissa, well, you know I could fit in a thimble. You know, when he was telling me that I just had this, and he said it so lovingly. He wasn't even mean about it. That was my father. And he was like, you don't know everything. You're not that smart. I suffer from perpetual know-it-all syndrome. That is a stumbling block. So you want to get better or not? And I discovered that I really could rely on a power that I didn't understand. I didn't have to understand what God's plan was in order to surrender to God's plan. And, you know, and then I was reminded about electricity, and I don't understand how electricity works, but I rely on it, that's for sure. I don't understand about the light switch and the power box and the fuse box, but I know I plug in a lamp because I don't want to be in the dark. And it was the same thing with this program. That was all that was required for me to make a start. You know, I find that the steps, you know, step three says this, we have to quit playing God. It didn't work. We decide that hereafter in this drama of life, God's going to be the director. He's the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass through freedom. And so when I sincerely take that position, it says, like, okay, you're going to all kinds of remarkable things are going to follow. You're going to get this new employer, all powerful. He's going to give you what you need if you keep close to him and perform his work well. And really, it's what you need, not necessarily what you want. Because I didn't want what I had gotten, but I guess it's what I needed. I don't, again, I don't understand it, but my understanding is not required. My surrendering is, my accepting is. And what I found out was that if I stay close to God and I perform his work well, and basically, I sort of take it as this: if I don't know what his work is, I'm pretty sure I know what it's not, right? It's not causing chaos. It's not causing conflict. It's looking to be peaceful. It's looking to be cooperative. It's certainly not eating myself till my mouth bleeds, right? It's not hating my sister for having children. It's not cringing because when I see my neighbor at the mailbox because she just had her fifth kid. And I remembered feeling that way too, right? It's not those things. If I stay close to God and perform his work well, I lose interest in my little plans and designs. And I get interested in what God got in store for me. And then I get peace of mind and I can face life successfully. And what happens to me then is I become conscious of his presence. Like, I get this God stirring. And when I have God stirring inside me, I'm not afraid of today, tomorrow, or even the hereafter, that we are, in a sense, reborn, right? So in step three, I find I'm going to have to turn my will and my path, my life over. My will and my life for me are my thoughts and my actions over to this God that I still haven't figured out, right? I knew I was failing at life. By the way, at this point, when I came here, I had two healthy children, a husband, a career, siblings. My mother was alive then and well. And I was eating myself to death. My little plans and designs were not working out. So then, what did I know about anything? I didn't even know how much food to eat. Why would I think that I would know how the entire universe should have unfolded for me? And, you know, and so what I found out in step four was that a life of that includes deep resentment leads to futility and unhappiness. Bingo, that's what I was living in. Futility and unhappiness. And so to the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours we that might have otherwise been worthwhile? I don't want to waste a single moment of my life. Like Amy had so eloquently shared. Yeah, like news alert, we all have an expiration date. Some of us just have I guess, more of a understanding of when that is, or a closer, understanding of the possibility of what it is. We really don't know anything. I don't want to waste a minute of my human life experience the way that I was living it before, hating people, cringing when I saw a baby. Like, I didn't want to live that way anymore. Who wants to live like that? If I was going to live, I had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They are the dubious luxury of normal men. But for alcoholics, these things are poison. So in step four and five, I learned that the resentments that I was feeling about my reality, it was wasting what I had. I was so angry, right? I told you I was angry at my sister who had five kids. I was angry at one of my best friends because she had four children. I was angry that my other best friend died. I was angry that my brother never talked about what happened. And I felt like he ignored me afterwards and never called me. My mother, God rest her soul, who insisted on reminding me all throughout my grief to put on my lipstick. My mother would say to me, Melissa, put on a little lipstick. Just put on a little lipstick. And I would get so angry at her. How dare you? Because I would feel like she was telling me to paint a fake smile on my face, right? And the truth is that my mother just, it was painful for her to see her daughter in so much pain. And she was also cognizant that I wasn't really showing up the way I needed to for my other children. That was the truth. And she was trying to tell me in her most loving way to get your shit together. Get your shit together, And so I had to let go of those resentments if I was going to live in peace. I remembered I began praying for the people and for the reality that had wronged me. And I believe that prayer works because it does. When I started doing it, it didn't work. I didn't believe it worked, but it worked nonetheless, whether I believed in it or not, it did work because suddenly I wasn't eating. It started just there. Suddenly, I wasn't eating, and I was willing to at least see it from another angle. And I remember the day when I suddenly remembered out of the blue that my siblings, who I was so angry with, had paid for the funeral for my son and arranged the whole thing. And I just showed up that morning. Like it was like I had never remembered that in the midst of my anger at them, And so, really, what has happened for me through recovery, and I know really today I thought I was going to come out and talk strictly about my mother, because what happened for me in this last few years, was my mother got dementia. And I want to say, I was going to start to say, and I had to, I didn't have to. God gave me the ability to, like, be my mother's person here on this planet. And when you stay close to God and perform his work well, what happened for me was God is so good. He took the thing that I had to do and he changed it into the thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to be by my mother's side. I felt an honor and a privilege to be on this planet with my mother at the same time that I had recovered years before my mother got dementia. My mother got to see me well. My mother rejoiced in my recovery. She was so happy that she saw it that I turned my life around. It's okay. I didn't turn my life around. God did it for me. But my mother was going to give me credit, right? And at the end, when I would go visit my mother, I got the privilege of putting on her lipstick for her, putting on her lipstick, because I knew it meant something to her. I knew it mattered to her. And, what happened for me was as my mother declined, I would cry. I would cry and cry and cry. It was so painful to show up for my mother like that because I didn't want to see her like that. It was just really difficult. And then God did the most miraculous thing for me. I fell in love with my mother in her dementia. I actually got the experience, God gave me the opportunity to mother my mother. That I got the opportunity to witness my mother as a toddler, as a child. And all the babies that I had mourned, all that loss, all that, it's not fair. I thought I would cry. I thought I was going to get to have many, many, many more children. But I got the experience of my mother as a child. Who gets that? Who gets that? So I could bring my mother an ice cream. I used to bring my mother an ice cream every day. And I would feed her ice cream. I could feel and I could touch it. Who cared? It didn't even look like ice cream to me. It was like the hug, the gift that I could give my mother. And the other beautiful thing that God did for me was I would show up to see my mother and I would fix my lipstick before getting out of the car because I knew my mother would want to see me with my lipstick on. And I would bring her ice cream. And when I would first walk in to the facility, my mother wouldn't recognize me sometimes. It would take her like a minute. And then other people, this is what God does also. You never know who you're really helping. There were other women there who never had children, and they would light up when I would come. I could get to hang out with them and talk to them, right? And then my mother would suddenly, I would see her recognize me, and the look that she would give me. Like, oh, you're so, and my mother would say, oh, you're so beautiful. And it was like, who gets that? And I realized, like, that was a gift. Had I eaten, I would have missed all of that. I would have missed all that. So, is it the way that I wanted my mother to go? God, no. My mother was so strong and capable and healthy before then. No, I didn't want to see her that way. But I believe that God gave me an assignment. And then he turned the assignment into something that gave me joy. Right. And then I was given an opportunity to share that with other people. And I walked through all of it. Not once did the food call my name. And I was actually with my mother, hugging her and kissing her as she took her last breath. I was holding her hand. I was kissing her. My food packed in my cooler, because I know my abstinence. If I lost my abstinence, I would never have been available to show up for my mother. And with that, I'll pass. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for your share. I will now stop the recording.